From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, our first guest will be James Weldon, a union organizer from South Florida. He'll be discussing the recent GE strike and the evolution of the labor movement's approach toward universal health care. Then, Amy Alina will be joining us to discuss the impact of the Women's Health Initiative's study of hormone replacement therapy and alternative approaches to some of the health problems associated with menopause. Amy Alina will also be providing today's opinion segment. She'll comment on recent appointees to an advisory panel that evaluates drugs that affect women's reproductive health at the Food and Drug Administration. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our first news item comes from Harris County, Texas. The American Civil Liberties Union filed a class action lawsuit against Harris County on behalf of a county jail inmate who has requested an abortion while in custody. Representatives of Harris County have stated that the reason the abortion is not being provided is that the county does not cover any elective surgery and that abortion is an elective surgical operation. A spokesperson for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice said that she would be responsible for the cost of the procedure as well as all costs associated with her prison guards who would accompany her as well as transportation. On the other hand, if she carried the pregnancy to term, the state government would take care of all expenses. The inmate was arrested on a probation violation and has been sentenced to serve 2 years in prison. She plans to renew her efforts to get an abortion, but she's unable to afford the costs involved. If she does give birth to the child, it's unclear if she will be forced to give the child up for adoption or if the prison system will support her raising a newborn child in a prison cell. The second news item is also a report of a class action suit. Two employees last month filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of AT&T's female employees, alleging that the failure of AT&T's health insurance plan to cover prescription contraceptives violates the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Last July, the company's health insurance plan finally began covering oral contraceptives when they were ordered by mail. But the lawsuit contests that the plan's failure to provide all other forms of birth control, including Depo Provera, IUDs, and diaphragms, is illegal because it does cover other sex-related prescription drugs for men, such as Viagra. The AT&T case follows several recent debates in state legislatures and courts, resulting in the enactment of legislation in 20 states requiring health insurance policies that cover prescription drugs to also include prescription contraceptives. A federal contraceptive coverage measure, however, has been stalled in Congress for over 18 months. The U.S. healthcare system already diverts a vastly higher proportion of medical dollars away from patient care into administration than any other developed country. Well, the January 28th issue of the Wall Street Journal reported on what may be the newest form of administrative expense in the U.S. healthcare system. The journal profiled a new company called Health Advocate. Several former executives from Aetna, the nation's largest health insurer, left Aetna to form a new venture. Health Advocate charges about $3 per person per month to help address denials of care and other health insurance issues. Quoting from the new company's literature, its purpose is to help patients maneuver through the denials, disappointments, and the dread caused by health insurers. Company officials boast that they have been successful in 80% of the cases they represent. But this could be viewed as disappointing, since Health Advocate does not pursue cases in which patients are not entitled to their requests. Dr. Abby Leibowitz, who was Aetna's chief medical officer in the 1990s and now holds the same position for the new company, noted that no one could be in a better position to deal with the techniques insurers use to deny care than the very people who developed and implemented those techniques. Thus far, 108 companies with a total of about 40,000 employees have signed up for the service. On January 23rd, the Bush administration appointed Jerry Thacker to the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS. Thacker is a marketing consultant who contracted HIV from his wife after she became infected through a blood transfusion. Mr. Thacker has organized a website, the Scepter Institute, that condemns homosexuality as a death style rather than a lifestyle, and has called AIDS a gay plague. Thacker also uses the website to sell religious-based AIDS education material that promotes abstinence. Within hours after the appointment, a firestorm of opposition came in from congressional representatives, AIDS activists, and many others. And hours later, the Bush administration withdrew Mr. Thacker from consideration. Editorials in several major newspapers applauded the withdrawal. In Pittsburgh, the Post-Gazette wrote that based on his statements on the subject, Thacker would have expressed a two-tier concern for HIV carriers, more for the heterosexuals and less for the gays, thereby polarizing the advisory commission. The Baltimore Sun wrote that the fact that Thacker was gone within hours of his appointment is good news, but the bad news is that he came so close to serving on a commission designed to advise the president on how to most effectively combat the pandemic disease. The editorial states that while diverse opinions are valuable to the commission, stopping the wildfire of AIDS that is afflicting men, women, and children around the world is far too grave a problem to waste time on ideas that are based on bigotry rather than sound science. In today's opinion segment later in the show, we'll hear more about the politicizing of appointees to scientific panels. We'll end our news update today on a positive note with a piece from the British Medical Journal. In the year 2000, a commentator in that journal pointed out that the digital divide was the greatest medical divide of all between the wealthy nations and the poor countries of the global south. Until very recently, health institutions in low-income countries had almost no access to international journals, and the few textbooks available were often years out of date. Internet access was a rare exception. Well, an initiative led by the World Health Organization has made impressive progress in the area. Less than 3 years later, more than 100 health institutions in the developing world have free electronic access to over 2,000 journals. All the major weekly medical scientific journals can be accessed for free. And on February 1st, access was extended beyond the poorest 68 countries in the world to an additional 42 nations. In July 2001, Gro Harlem Brundtland, the Director General of the World Health Organization, announced the launch of the Health Internetwork Access to Research Initiative, a voluntary partnership between the World Health Organization and 28 publishers to provide access to health information to institutions in the developing world. The initiative has transformed information access in a very short time, but it addresses only part of the problem. Access to the internet in the developing world is still limited and expensive. Further steps, probably in paper rather than electronic form, need to be taken to reach the frontline health workers out in the villages. There is also a plan to replicate the program for information on agriculture and the environment. Coming up next, the evolving attitude of the labor movement toward the movement for national health insurance in the U.S. So stay with us. Thank you. This is Public Health Radio. Another news item, one that did penetrate the national media during the last month, was a nationwide strike against General Electric over health care benefits. In fact, it was the lead item on the ABC Evening News on January 14th.
From ABC News World Headquarters in New York, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings.
Good evening, everyone. We're going to begin tonight with the cost of health care, because today it has caused the first national strike at General Electric in 33 years, which once again highlights the effect that health care has on the whole economy. Today at GE, 18,000 workers went on strike in 23 states. It was intended as a warning to the company that there is more trouble ahead when the company passes on the cost of health care to employees. Our first report is from ABC's Betsy Stark.
Thousands of workers braved the bitter cold to protest the rising health care costs GE has imposed on its workers and retirees.
Their top five execs made over $41 million in cash compensation. That's where the cost should be made up.
GE is expecting record profits this year, but the company says with its health care costs up 45% in the past 3 years and still rising, the time has come for workers to pay more.
Later in the ABC News segment, Betsy Stark interviews a worker whose medical costs will be rising by over $1,000 a year because his child recently underwent a kidney transplant. The worker points out that GE is placing a financial penalty on workers whose families are already suffering from the impact of major illnesses. General Electric's total health care-related expenses in the U.S. have risen from under $1 billion in 1999 to $1.4 billion in 2002. Commenting publicly on the strike, Bill Conaty, GE's Senior Vice President for Human Resources, said that it was difficult for businesses in the U.S. to stay globally competitive while sustaining the double-digit percentage increases that we have seen in recent years and expect for the foreseeable future. In fact, the per capita cost of health care in the U.S. is nearly twice as great as in most all the other developed countries. Joining us on Public Health Radio today to comment on the GE strike and the recent evolution of labor movement involvement in health care issues is James Weldon. Mr. Weldon is the business manager of Local 728 of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers in southeastern Florida and president of the Broward County, Florida Building and Construction Trades Council, which represents 20,000 members. James Weldon, welcome to Public Health Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here, Doctor.
Now, those who are active in the labor movement have realized for some time that health insurance coverage has been requiring ever-increasing attention. But I believe that the recent two-day-long nationwide strike against GE that took place earlier in January was the first time that the issue really came front and center to the attention of the wider public. Do you think that this two-day strike at GE will be a watershed moment, or do you just think it's another minor event in the same general direction? What's your feeling about that?
I think there's a good chance that this is going to turn out to be an important thing. When I was walking out of my condo the second morning of the strike, one of my neighbors come up and said, "Hey, Jim, you know, and there those unions go again. They're lucky enough to have health benefits and on like that. And, you know, where many of us don't have any, and here you guys going on strike." So I talked to him a little bit, and I convinced him that just the fact that he brought the subject up was, you know, the best testimony on how appropriate a thing it was to do. I think that the national media attention that it got, and if we can keep it boiling a little bit at least, is a big boost, a positive boost. And I think that it's brought it to the attention of many more union members around the country, importantly, too. I think it's there. I think it helped.
Labor unions have many issues besides health insurance to deal with. It's kind of obvious, the salary, vacation benefits, workplace issues, safety, discipline, and many others. You obviously know that. Now, has the need to focus on health insurance been a diversion from unions and kind of prevented them from dealing effectively with some of these other issues?
You know, the constant struggle over the years between labor and management at the bargaining table over health care issues has no question had a negative effect on overall labor-management relations. So it's had a very, very negative effect on our building trade unions in so many ways.
Tell me about that.
Well, we're on the cutting edge of free enterprise in construction. In the construction trades, that's how it is. We're in a highly competitive industry where usually the low bid gets the contract. We're losing work every day to non-union employers, general contractors, electrical contractors, plumbing contractors, who largely pay nothing towards the health care of their employees. Now, this is putting our union contractors to a 15 to 20% disadvantage on every job that they bid. Our union's building trades contractors are losing tens of millions of lost man hours to non-union contractors whose uninsured employees' health care costs are in fact subsidized by us. We, the insured elite, as I like to call them, through hospital cost shifting and taxes, we pay three times. We think the solution is a universal health care system for all Americans. I refer to it as Medicare for all.
So you've come to believe that universal insurance would benefit Americans and would also benefit labor unions and unionized workers. Is this something that is now becoming the rule among people who are involved in organized labor, or are you in the forefront? Or are you the exception?
Well, the really good news, Marvin, is that at the last two AFL-CIO conventions, resolutions were adopted supporting universal health care. Now, that's the first time that I'm aware that such resolutions have come forth. I guess you'd say the bad news is that there are internal pressures within the AFL-CIO which are tending to keep universal health care on a lower priority.
Do you know why?
You know, I don't understand why, and I'm not specifically conversant with which unions they are because the ground has shifted on it. And some that were are no longer, and exactly who those are that are opposed to it, I'm not up to date on, so I'd rather not say. But as a general rule, your public employee unions were, I emphasize, were opposed to it. And there was a tendency for all unions to consider, certainly 15 years or so ago, 10 years or so ago, that it was an organizing tool, the fact that we had insurance. But, you know, with continuing privatization happening in the public sector, now they realize the competitiveness of that situation because they're losing their jobs to so-called privatization, basically on their benefits and certainly their health care. When a city government, as an example, subcontracts out some type of work that maybe 50 public employees were doing, the contractor who wins that award is winning it on the basis that he doesn't and isn't paying any health care benefits.
Which puts them in the exact same position that you are in your situation.
That's why they're swinging. That's exactly why they're swinging. We're hoping to make it a priority issue. And more people listening to you.
So do you see nationally that some significant muscle is going to be behind the issue, or is it simply a policy position that they took?
No, I believe that universal health care is finally being seriously talked about in the international union's headquarters. And I think the labor movement, of course, you know, one of the reasons why this isn't the priority is that we're always on the defensive. You know, we're fighting for our survival on a lot of very important issues, job safety, you name it. But the international unions certainly are listening to their local unions. And every day there's more local unions reaching the conclusion that it's time that the labor movement got behind this great, what I consider to be truly historic struggle. You know, idealistically, you know, we were there on so many important social issues, the labor movement. Child labor laws, you know, the 40-hour work week, you know, hey folks, it was the unions that brought you weekends, civil rights. We were there. It won't be long, and we definitely will be coming out strong for health care for all Americans. Single payer, universal health care. I think it's the recognition that Americans have a right to health. Not just the wealthy or insured elite, but all Americans.
Do the workers in your local feel this way too?
My membership overwhelmingly supports everything that I've said. The membership of some 35 unions in Southeast Florida would endorse every word that I've said. And we are working to elevate the entire subject to a priority goal of the AFL-CIO legislative dreams, if you will. We were successful in passing a resolution precisely requesting that of the National AFL-CIO. On the basis of that resolution, I've been talking to a couple of the top assistants to the presidents and so on. And I think its time is coming. It's no question. It's time it's coming, and should have come a long time ago.
Can you recommend any organizations or websites for listeners who may wish to learn more about the role that labor is taking in this struggle for national health care?
You know who I'm really impressed with is the organization called Physicians for a National Health Program. Their website is pnhp.org. There's a really, really special group of doctors, highly dedicated to their professions, that make up the membership of this group. They've been spending a lot of time and energy and effort trying to bring this about, and I believe they have over 10,000 doctors members. That's about the best recommendation I got. And I would hope that before too long, I'll be able to say that, yeah, you can dial it up on the AFL-CIO web.
But not yet.
Not yet. But it's going to happen.
Well, James Weldon, thanks again for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Sure. It's been my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Coming up next, Amy Alina will be joining us to discuss hormone replacement therapy and the medicalization of menopause. So stay with us. Thank you. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. With the recent publication of the results from the Women's Health Initiative, doctors, researchers, and women are having to rethink their attitudes toward menopause. For decades, most doctors believed that the benefits of hormonal treatments outweighed the risks for most menopausal women. The results surprised many doctors, even experts in the field. Joining us today to discuss the Women's Health Initiative and the medicalization of menopause is Amy Alina. Amy is the Program and Policy Director of the National Women's Health Network. In that capacity, she plans and implements the network's policy agenda on a range of issues, including menopause, reproductive health, access to health care, and regulation of drugs and devices for women. She represents the organization with government agencies, legislative bodies, and the media. Amy is also a member of the board of directors of My Sister's Place, a shelter for battered women and their children in Washington, D.C., and is also a member of the board of directors of the Reproductive Health Technologies Project. Her academic studies occurred at Harvard University in the fields of political science and history. She is co-author of the recently published book, The Truth About Hormone Replacement Therapy, How to Break Free from the Medical Myths of Menopause. That book is available through the Prima Publishing House. Amy Alina, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you very much.
So tell us about the recent Women's Health Initiative study that was released. What was the structure of the study?
It was a very well-designed study, and it was, as you said, it was the first large, well-designed study on healthy postmenopausal women that used a randomized control trial format, which means that women were compared in two different groups, one who were taking the hormones and one who were not. And in fact, what people refer to as a single study, the Women's Health Initiative, is actually a series of studies, one of which compared women who were taking estrogen alone to women not taking a placebo. One compared women taking estrogen plus a progestin to women taking a placebo. And there's also a segment of the study that's looking at the effect of a low-fat diet and calcium and vitamin D supplementation in women. So it's important to understand that there are all these different parts to the study and to understand that this was the largest study of its kind that's been done.
And who funded the study?
It's paid for by the National Institutes of Health, which is the federal government's health research agency. And that's also a very important point because many of the studies that get covered in the news with important new results are funded by companies that have an interest in the outcome of the research, that have they actually have a financial stake in the findings, and that's not the case with this research.
So tell us about the results of the study. What surprised everyone so much?
The first thing that surprised everyone was that the study was stopped early. We didn't expect results this quickly, but what happened was that when the researchers looked at the overall results, they found that in the long term, women in the study were more likely to be harmed by hormone therapy than helped. And because of that finding, they were ethically bound to stop the study early. In the estrogen and progestin arm, they found that the risks of taking hormone therapy were greater than the benefits. And for that reason, they were ethically bound to stop that part of the study. There were some positive findings. Hormone therapy was shown to be effective in reducing the risk of hip fracture and colon cancer. But these benefits were outweighed by the increased risk for breast cancer, heart attack, stroke, and blood clots.
Now, women who don't have a uterus are generally put on estrogen alone. Is that arm of the study been reported yet, and are there any has anything been reported about that group?
No early results from the estrogen only arm have been released, but we do know two things about that part of the study. first, we know that the risks have not yet been found to significantly outweigh the benefits. Otherwise, that part would in all likelihood have been stopped as well. And the second thing we know is that women in that arm did receive a letter warning them of an increased risk of cardiovascular events in years 1 and 2 of the study. And it wasn't enough of a risk to stop the trial, but because it was an unanticipated risk that women who enrolled in the study hadn't been warned about, medical ethics required that they be notified. And it's also important to realize that this arm of the study, the arm where women are taking estrogen alone, women who do not have a uterus, this arm is smaller, so it would take longer for the number of adverse events to reach statistical significance in all likelihood. And it's very important that we not interpret continuation of the estrogen-only arm as a demonstration of effectiveness or lack of harm. It's just that we don't know yet.
Also, research can be stopped if results are favorable.
That's true. And it's clear from the fact that that arm has not yet been stopped that the results haven't been so favorable and clear that they felt ready to stop it.
Now, give us some historical background on why this was so surprising to everyone. What did all the previous studies seem to show about the long-term effects of a hormone replacement?
Well, there have been a lot of different studies on a lot of different possible endpoints or outcomes. How does hormone therapy affect a whole variety of different conditions and diseases? And the results have been mixed. Previous randomized control trials looking at heart disease also didn't show a benefit, but observational studies indicated that estrogen or hormone therapy might actually prevent cardiovascular disease. And that's part of the reason that people were so surprised. These observational studies that looked at women who had chosen to take hormone therapy found that those women, in fact, were healthier. And many, many doctors and researchers assumed that that meant that if women hadn't taken the hormone therapy, they would have experienced more heart disease. But that's why it was so important to do the Women's Health Initiative trial that compared the two groups who were randomly assigned to the medications that they took. And probably the reason the observational studies showed the results that they did was a result of selection bias. Women who chose to take hormone therapy in the past did that because they believed it was going to make them healthier, and these were also women who were doing other things to make themselves healthier, so there was this bias of healthier women to be the ones taking hormones.
Also, healthier women generally are wealthier, and poor women might have less access to doctors to even consider taking hormones. They may not have insurance to pay for the hormones.
That's also a very important point.
Now, hormone replacement treatment has been prescribed for decades, and it's only now, many years into the use of hormone treatment, that we're finally getting a study that's asking this rather obvious question. Why wasn't the study done sooner? Do we know that?
I think we do know that. I think the reason the study wasn't done sooner is because this is a very clear example of the triumph of marketing over science. And it's also a result of the way our drug regulation system works, or, depending on your perspective, doesn't work. Because hormone therapy had been approved for a use in this country, it had been approved for treatment of hot flashes and reducing the risk of bone fracture, both of which are proven indications. It was available for doctors to prescribe for anything. And as you said, for decades, the companies that manufactured these drugs have been marketing them in ways that took the little bit of scientific information that was out there and presented it so that doctors and women believed that these drugs worked for things that had never been proven and in some cases never even been studied. And the companies had no interest in doing the study that was going to show that it didn't work for that, so they went ahead with the marketing based on the information that existed. And well-meaning doctors who have been taught from the very beginning of their medical education genuinely believed it and prescribe these drugs. In fact, there were doctors who stood up and argued against doing a study like the Women's Health Initiative because they said it would be unethical to randomly assign women not to take estrogen because they knew, they were 100% sure that it worked.
The reason that the results of the Women's Health Initiative were so surprising is that everyone involved, women and doctors as well, as you're pointing out, had come to believe and perhaps been inculcated with what proved to be unsubstantiated claims. Describe what you found when you looked at the drug industry's efforts to influence the medical profession.
Well, it's extensive beyond what most patients imagine. We're talking about billions of dollars that are spent every year to influence doctors' prescribing practices. And this is done through a whole variety of different techniques. Some of them have gotten a little bit of media attention. The most blatant bribes and junkets that doctors are taken on to sit for half an hour and listen to a lecture about a drug and then go out golfing for the day, or actually being given money to speak about a drug that they've, again, heard a short lecture on. But it goes much deeper than that. Drug companies go into medical schools and do lectures there. Drug companies fund and organize a lot of the continuing medical education programs that doctors are required to participate in and to order to keep their credentials current. Drug companies send sales representatives to doctors' offices on a weekly basis to provide them with information about the drugs that they are trying to market. These sales representatives bring studies to the doctors to prove that their drugs are effective, but the studies may be true and yet misleading. They may be studies like the observational studies we were discussing earlier that are subject to selection bias but give the appearance of showing a drug's efficacy. And all of these different techniques that the companies use end up being the main sources that doctors use for learning about new developments. So drug companies end up being able to touch almost every source of information that a doctor has.
I can depressingly affirm everything you just said, and it's really upsetting, and it's something I greatly regret. But I have to say that the first part of your book goes on to give me information, actually, as a physician, a practicing physician, I didn't know. And that had to do with the efforts of the pharmaceutical industry to permeate the consumer side of this equation, and I was wondering if you can talk a bit about that.
Sure, I'd be glad to. I mean, this is, as you said, it's a very depressing situation, and it's another situation where well-meaning people have been misled by marketing that's designed to look like education. Drug companies have worked out deals with a lot of different health advocacy organizations where they will fund a so-called education campaign about the disease that is of concern to the women who are members of the advocacy organization and of concern to the company that has a drug they're trying to sell to treat that disease or prevent that disease. And in the vast majority of cases, the information that the companies provide is true but misleading, just as it is with the doctors. So organizations that think they're doing their due diligence and looking into whether this information is true and whether it's been published in reputable journals may find that it is, but if they don't ask the right questions, they won't see that while it's true, it is misleading.
So to summarize, what you're saying is that the pharmaceutical industry is now insinuating its money and therefore its power into women's publications and women's...
I don't think there's any question that that's true. You can look around and see on many websites and written materials that are published by organizations that do very good work on women's health that some of their educational materials are paid for by what are called unrestricted grants from pharmaceutical companies.
I just want to point out to listeners that listeners may now feel frustrated that they're trying to get information from various sources and don't know whether those sources have been influenced by the pharmaceutical industry. I just wanted to point out that your book actually includes information on some organizations that have not received pharmaceutical industry money as of last year.
That's true. And in addition, we have a fact sheet that we provide free to anyone who wants it and that you can get off of our website that gives women some ideas of questions to ask if you're considering taking a drug that might help you figure out whether the information you're being provided with is really reliable. Information about how will you be able to tell if the product is working, what kinds of studies have been done, what are the sort of words that you need to look for in evaluating whether these are the right studies, and how do you understand the numbers that are given in terms of how much benefit you might get or what kind of risk there is.
Now, because many women actually developed side effects they notice from the standard hormone replacement therapy, a number of synthetic estrogen-like drugs have been developed that are not exactly the same as the natural estrogen. And some of these new compounds, these artificial compounds, are already on the market.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a bit about these drugs and whether they've been tested for long-term benefit and risk?
Sure. In this context, what we're talking about are drugs that are known as SERMs, or sometimes they're called designer estrogens. And the idea of developing the SERMs was to come up with something that would give the benefits of estrogens without the risks. And the SERM that are on the market and are used in the way that HRT was used are used for osteoporosis, for preventing bone fractures. So they have been studied, not in the way that the Women's Health Initiative studied hormone therapy. The companies have done fairly good-sized randomized controlled trials for Food and Drug Administration approval. But they've only looked at the effects for about 3 to 5 years. And that's enough to get approval, but it means that nobody really knows what the effect of taking a SERM for 20 to 30 years will be. The drugs haven't been around that long, and it's not possible to know. And yet, women who start taking these drugs at menopause are looking at possible decades of use to prevent hip fractures, which usually don't happen until a woman's in her 80s.
So the bottom line is that we're not going to know the long-term impact because the studies aren't being done?
It's true. That study isn't being done. This is the best information we have at the time, and women are having to make healthcare decisions based on incomplete information.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm Marvin Malik. My guest today is Amy Alina, and we've been discussing the results of the Women's Health Initiative, the first high-quality study on the effects of hormone replacement therapy. After the break, we'll be discussing alternatives to hormonal therapy to control some of the health problems related to menopause. Then, later in the show, Amy will provide our opinion segment on the significance of recent Bush administration appointees to the Reproductive Health Drugs Advisory Committee at the Food and Drug Administration. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. My guest is Amy Alina, the Program and Policy Director of the National Women's Health Network and co-author of the recently published book, The Truth About Hormone Replacement Therapy. Back to the interview. Now, the menopausal period is associated with a number of health problems which can be uncomfortable. In fact, that's how the use of estrogen began. Women were getting hot flashes, and trying estrogen seemed like a reasonable idea, and that was done, and the women benefited.
Mm-hmm.
Other issues associated with menopause are dangerous, like osteoporosis, thinning of the bones, which can lead to hip fractures. So can you go through some of the menopausal issues and talk about some of the non-drug treatments that may help.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I'd be glad to do that. Hot flashes is a really tough one, and if women are having very bad hot flashes, estrogen is the thing that's been shown to work the most effectively. And that's a decision that women are going to have to make, weighing the risk and the benefit. Are the hot flashes severe enough that they're willing to take on the risks that we now know are associated with taking hormone therapy? But even though the research backing up alternative treatments for hot flashes isn't as strong as the evidence showing the effectiveness of hormones for this problem, many women do find ways to handle hot flashes that don't involve taking hormones. And people who want to try a non-hormonal alternative should remember that what works for one woman may not help another, and if one strategy doesn't get you the relief you're looking for, you can try another. One of the strategies that some women find to be effective are dietary strategies. Women make dietary changes like avoiding caffeine or chocolate, spicy and hot foods, and alcohol, because those are all foods that sometimes aggravate hot flashes. And some women have found that eating plant foods that contain natural estrogens, which are called phytoestrogens, can be helpful in reducing hot flashes. And foods that have phytoestrogens are beans and legumes. People often talk about soybeans having phytoestrogens, which they do, but other beans do as well. Another strategy, and this is so simple that people often laugh when I say it, but it's something that a lot of women rely on, which is just try to stay cool. Wear clothes in layers during the day and at night so that you can take clothes off quickly if your internal temperature rises. And make sure the layer that you wear under the jacket that you're putting on to go to work is something that you don't mind showing if you need to take your jacket off during a meeting.
Sometimes the simplest strategies are the most elegant and effective.
It's true. And another thing is keep a portable battery-powered fan with you that you can turn on and cool yourself down when you have a hot flash. Then there also are things that have been studied scientifically in a few small studies, like paced breathing. Two studies have found that slow, deep breathing reduced the frequency of hot flashes. Some women get relief from hot flashes with herbs. Black cohosh has been found to have some effectiveness for this, but there aren't any published human studies on long-term safety of black cohosh, and there's no study that's been published of taking it for longer than 6 months. So we recommend to women who try that to treat their hot flashes, we recommend that they not continue use beyond 6 months since it hasn't been studied.
And then one of the more dangerous consequences of menopause is the rapid bone loss that occurs in the years following that.
Right.
Talk about some other approaches other than just taking
sure.
more estrogen.
There are non-drug alternatives for making and keeping bones strong, and these include exercise and supplements that have calcium and vitamin D. The National Institutes of Health produced a consensus statement on osteoporosis a couple of years ago in which they reviewed all the research on osteoporosis prevention and treatment, and they found strong scientific evidence that calcium and vitamin D intake are crucial to develop and preserve strong bones, and also that regular exercise, especially resistance and high-impact activities, can also contribute to the development of bone mass, which is important in countering the bone loss. Another really good thing about exercise is that it can reduce the risk of falls in older people, which are often responsible for broken bones. If you have thin bones and they never break, that's not a problem. It's a problem because the thin bones are more likely to break, and preventing falls is an effective way of keeping thin bones from breaking. What exercise does is both increase your strength and increase your balance, and through doing that, you become less likely to fall. There are also, again, some common sense measures that you can take to reduce the risk of falling and breaking a bone, like making sure that your vision prescription is up to date, checking with a doctor about any prescription drugs you're taking to make sure that there aren't drug interactions happening that might cause dizziness, eliminating fall-causing hazards in your house, like small, slippery rugs, and wearing shoes that you're less likely to fall down in. The bottom line is that if you want to prevent falls and fractures, there are better options for most women than hormones, including both the drug alternatives and the non-drug alternatives. There are age-related concerns that women need to pay attention to, and osteoporosis is one of them. Not every older woman is going to experience thinning bones that will lead to fractures, but the natural thinning of bones that takes place as you get older can be a problem for some women, and the problem is partly determined by genetics. Do you have a family history of this? And partly determined by whether you've had a diet and physical activity history that led you to build up your peak bone mass. So for women over 65, it's a reasonable thing to do to check into whether you have a problem with thinning bones and whether this is something you need to be paying attention to. And the way you do that is with a bone density screening test and a medical history with your doctor. Unfortunately, the tests that we have at this point aren't great predictors of fracture, but they're the best we have, and taken in conjunction with a medical history and a family history, you and your doctor probably can figure out whether this is a big concern for you.
Now, I decided to discuss the Women's Health Initiative at the beginning of this interview, since the study was published quite recently, and its results have been so surprising and in many ways have revolutionized the field of menopausal care. But I actually have regret about starting out this interview focusing on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a doctor. Drugs are far and away most commonly used to treat diseases. And the implication of starting out a discussion of menopause with talking about drugs, I fear that it gives listeners the notion that menopause is a disease. And I was wondering, what are your feelings about that?
I'm really glad you asked me that. Menopause is not a disease, and women's experiences with it vary greatly. Some women go through menopause and have no problems. They feel better. Others have real problems with hot flashes, and others end up experiencing diseases that are related to aging that they may associate with menopause. And these diseases that are related to aging are a valid concern for women. But linking it to menopause has misdirected a lot of that concern. And it's been a very effective marketing technique, but it hasn't benefited women's health. What it's done is play on women's concerns about aging and sexism in our society about what we think about older women, and used both of those to sell drugs to women that they may not need. So I hope your listeners will take away a message that it's perfectly possible to go through menopause and to become an older woman without experiencing these problems. But if you are experiencing these problems, there are things you can do other than taking hormones that may help you more.
Tell us, how can listeners obtain more information about this issue of menopause and possible drug treatment of menopause?
Well, I'll take this opportunity to shamelessly promote my book. The Truth About Hormone Replacement Therapy is a book that was written by a collaborative of women that I was a part of, and it was published last year by a publishing company, Prima Publishing, and you can order this book from a bookstore. It's called The Truth About Hormone Replacement Therapy, and it's written by the National Women's Health Network. You can also order it off of our website directly if that's easier for you, and the website address is womenshealthnetwork.org. On that website, you'll also find shorter pieces about menopause that might be useful to you, fact sheets that you can order or download and print, and information packets that are available to order.
Amy, let's just switch topics for a second at the end here. And I know that your organization has put out an alert about some recent appointments of the Bush administration. And before we close, I was wondering if you could tell our listeners about some of those concerns and what actions perhaps concerned listeners might take.
Sure. I'd really like to do that. Last fall, President Bush announced that he was interested in appointing a doctor whose name was David Hager to head up a committee at the Food and Drug Administration, the Reproductive Health Drugs Advisory Committee. And women's health advocates were really alarmed by this news because this is a committee that is responsible for offering expert scientific and medical advice to the Food and Drug Administration on matters relating to the drugs that are used in the practice of obstetrics, gynecology, and related specialties. Their responsibilities include all contraceptive drugs and drugs used in performing medical abortion, as well as drugs used for infertility treatments and hormone replacement therapy that we've been talking about today. And the committee traditionally has been made up of leading scientists in the field. Dr. Hager is a practicing obstetrician-gynecologist, and he's written some books about women's health, but one of his books makes a suggestion that women who suffer from premenstrual syndrome or other hormonal problems should seek help from reading the Bible and praying. And this may be something that some women find to be effective, but Dr. Hager's track record and his career has been about bringing his personal ideological beliefs to guide medical decision-making and recommendations. And we felt that really called into question his ability to chair the committee. So we were very concerned about it. And what has happened is that the administration got such a strong reaction from the public against that appointment that they backed off on making Dr. Hager the chair. They did, however, appoint him and a couple of other people who have similar beliefs to his to this committee. So we have notified all of our members and tried to get the word out to the general public that even though we had this partial victory in having them back off making him the chair, what's happened with this committee is that the administration has brought a political agenda to what was previously a science-based committee. And we've asked people to let the commissioner of the FDA know that they're really concerned about this. And the commissioner's name is Mark McClellan, and he can be reached by email at commissioner@fda.gov. So if you want to let the Bush administration know how you feel about them using a scientific advisory committee for political payback to the anti-choice movement, this is how you can do it. Email the commissioner and tell him that you think this committee should be made up of people who have strong scientific credentials and make decisions based on science.
Well, Amy, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And I hope you'll join us again soon.
I would like that.
Well, that's it for today's show. This show and all previous airings of Public Health Radio can be heard online at our website, publichealthradio.org. You can also provide feedback on the show and suggestions for future topics at the website. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.